the people called Methodists, from the Irish Free State to the Irish Republic. In 1995, I was approached by one of the secretaries in the department of the Taoiseach, who told me that the newly elected Taoiseach, John Bruton, wished to know how the members of minority churches had fared since the establishment of the Irish Free State following the Treaty of 1921. I was given to understand that approaches were being made to historians in the Church of Ireland and the Presbyterian Church, asking them to write accounts of their respective denominations, and I was asked to do the same for the Methodist Church in Ireland. Over the next 12 months, I set about compiling this report, which I duly sent to Mr. Bruton in 1996. Recent events, discoveries which I have made since the 1990s, and the changing atmosphere in the country have moved me to look again at what I wrote and to revise and expand it. Methodism was introduced into Ireland in the latter half of the 18th century by its founder, the Reverend John Wesley, and his preachers. Wesley was a clergyman of the Church of England, and he and his preachers, with very few exceptions at the time, preached in English. These two factors limited their appeal in this country, where a great many of the rural population still used Irish as their first language. Though there are records of many hearing Wesley and hearing him with respect, most of the Irish speakers would have regarded his work as directed primarily to the Protestant people, and therefore of little reference to themselves. Indeed, there is evidence in his journal that Wesley himself saw his mission as directed mainly to the Church of Ireland. Accordingly, most of those who joined the Methodist societies here were of British, Huguenot, or German stock. At the beginning of the 19th century, when the Irish Methodist Conference appointed a number of Irish-speaking preachers, this pattern changed. The greatest concentration of Methodists were in the regions which have been called the Linen Triangle and the Loch Earn Rectangle in Ulster. It should be noted that these were areas in which English settlers predominated in the plantation of the 17th century. Where Presbyterianism predominated, Methodism made very little impact. In the other provinces, Methodists were to be found in somewhat greater numbers in the cities of Dublin, Cork, Limerick, and Waterford, and in the rural areas of West Cork, North Tipperary, Offaly, and Waterford. Central Limerick. The three rural areas were those of the Elizabethan plantation after the Barrymore Rising, strong Cornwallian settlement in the middle of the 17th century, and Palatine settlement at the beginning of the 18th century. However, none of these areas had anything like the same concentrations as the Ulster regions. In the political uncertainties of the period, when the London government was constantly suspicious of Jacobite conspiracies, Wesley and his people were suspected of being subversive, and on occasion were the victims of hostile mobs, tolerated if not actually incited by the magistrates. One consequence of this was the frequent Methodist protestation of loyalty to the powers that were, a protestation that developed in later years into a generally unionist political stance. In England, Methodism won a considerable following among the urban, middle, and working classes. From these classes were recruited some of the people who staffed the British administration at local and national levels. The presence of these English Methodists strengthened the Unionists' view in Irish Methodism. Thus, very briefly, may be sketched the background of Methodism in this country when the Irish Free State was established. Statistics. In dealing with Methodist statistics, three factors need to be borne in mind. Firstly, from its origin as a religious society within the established church, Methodism has retained a definition of membership which is somewhat restricted. In addition to those who are counted as members, there have been many who have attended Methodist worship and other Methodist meetings, but have not been so counted. The total Methodist community, therefore, has always been larger than the membership. Statistics have been kept in greater detail for the membership than for the total community. Further, the national census returns have usually shown an even greater number of people describing themselves as Methodists than are counted in the church's total community. Clearly, people who no longer had any active connection with the church continued to apply the name to themselves, and increasing willingness of people to describe themselves as of no religion may reduce this difference in future. Secondly, as is the case with other Christian denominations in the country, administrative boundaries in Methodism have not coincided with political boundaries. In attempting, therefore, to adduce figures for the Free State or the Republic, there must be a small margin of error in areas close to the border with Northern Ireland. Thirdly, it needs to be said that church statistics have been compiled by people who have no training as statisticians. Some may bring a measure of impatience to the completion of forms. Boards responsible for membership figures may be influenced by emotional considerations and may be more willing on occasion to record the accession of a member than to write off one who appears to have lapsed. Some years ago, there was an agitation for change in the calculation of the general assessment, which met some or all of the costs of church administration, ministerial pensions, theological education, youth work, and the acquisition and maintenance of certain properties. Proponents of the change wished to discontinue the calculation of part of this assessment on the membership of the societies, arguing that it reduced the number of members. This was a polite way of saying that some of the circuits falsified their membership figures to reduce the amount they had to pay. Fluctuations in the total community of Methodism have reflected political history, and most notably in the Free State / Republic. There, the community declined by 33% in the 10 years after 1920. It took another 40 years to lose a second 33%. In this, the census figures correspond quite closely with the church records. What factors determine the loss of numbers in the Free State Republic? Throughout the years, Methodism gained and lost members for a variety of purely personal reasons. Those apart, a number of influential factors can be recognized. One was internal migration, and another emigration, at both of which we must look in the next section. A third factor is impossible to quantify, the factor of marriage. Where a Methodist married a member of another Protestant denomination, a decision was made by the couple as to which church they would attend in the future. The general, but not invariable, rule was for the wife to go to the husband's church. Thus, there could be a loss or a gain for the Methodist membership. The implications of possible marriage with a Roman Catholic were much more complex. The terms of the Ne Temere decree required the Roman Catholic partner to sign an undertaking that the children would be brought up as Roman Catholics, and until the development of the ecumenical movement, a Roman Catholic married to a Protestant would be denied the sacraments. However, not every Roman Catholic contemplating a marriage with a Protestant was willing to sign the undertaking. At one time, I had to conduct a marriage between a Methodist fellow and a Roman Catholic girl. The couple had gone to the bishop of the diocese seeking a license to be married in her church. The bishop refused, as neither was willing to sign the undertaking. The fellow's father, knowing that a wedding in the Methodist church would hurt the girl's family, went to the local parish priest to ask if there was any way around the bishop's insistence. The priest said that there was not, and added the interesting comment, "I wish that there were, because this is losing me more people than it is gaining." A fourth factor in Methodist discipline was the withdrawal of services. When the attendance at a particular church became so small that it was no longer practical to maintain the regular services there, surviving members did not always travel to the next nearest Methodist church. They were more likely to attend a Protestant church of another denomination more conveniently located. Sooner or later, they would cease to be counted as Methodists. Internal migration and emigration. When a family moves from one circuit to another, if they are in membership, certain papers pass between the ministers of the circuits concerned. In one circuit, they are recorded as removed, and in the other, as received. In theory, the totals of these removed and these received, taken over the whole country, should tally. Given the circumstances in which statistics are gathered, it is hardly surprising that they occasionally didn't. What is surprising? That for most of the period between 1920 and 1995, they agree precisely. Only in the last years is there a significant margin of error. This certainly arises from the disturbances of the violent campaign in Northern Ireland. In spite of this, the figures give some indication of the movement of Methodist people within Ireland as a whole. They show a common trend in Northern Ireland and the Free State stroke Republic, a tendency to move towards the largest conurbation. When the Belfast district was divided in 1974, the move appears to have been to the Down district, which included the conurbation south of Belfast Lock and the growing town of Newton Ards. In fact, that trend was probably well established before the realignment of districts revealed it. More significant is the move from the Free State into Northern Ireland. In the 5 years between 1915 and 1920, for example, 165 members left Waterford, Cork, Limerick, and Sligo, but only 114 were received in Dublin. Since we are talking about migration inside Ireland, the other 51 could only have gone to what was shortly to be Northern Ireland. As it is possible that some of those received in Dublin could have come from Northern Ireland, the migration northwards was probably greater than 51. In the 10 years from 1920 to 1930, the number who crossed into Northern Ireland was at least 291. In the following decade, the number was small, But between 1940 and 1970, the total was above 378, an average of 12 and 13 a year. Thereafter, the margin of error in the statistics is too high for useful conclusions. When Methodists leave Ireland to live in any other country, they are recorded as emigrated. No note is taken centrally of the destination of the emigrants, and it may not be recorded locally either. The peak of emigration, prompted by the political changes, appears to have come in the Free State counties between 1915 and 1925, while that in Northern Ireland began and ended 5 years later. At a first glance, the emigration from Belfast appears to be as great as that from Dublin, but a comparison with the membership figures in the two districts shows that this is not the case, as Belfast had a much greater membership. The emigration of Methodists from the Free State has more than one explanation. As we have noted in the introduction, some Methodists were British people living here for the sake of the work they were doing in the civil service or as coast guards. When their work no longer required them to be here, they simply went home. Incidentally, the only Methodist family ever recorded as living on the Aran Islands were there because the father was a coast guard. Given the unpopularity of anyone in that service, their life must have been a lonely one. The census report of 1926 noted that in 1911, the Methodists domiciled in what became the Free State, 1,021 were serving in the army, the Royal Navy, or the police. A sense of insecurity under the new regime would have led these to transfer their domicile to the United Kingdom. Of course, they took their dependents with them. There were also those who wished to continue to live under a British administration and could afford to do so. While all that is true, there is another side to the coin. Some 50 years ago, I spoke to an elderly Methodist lady who told me a different story. When the Free State was established, her husband said to her, "There are a lot of our people going, but the country will need some of us, and we'll stay." Others took a similar line. Owners of farms or businesses were more likely to stay, but they were not the only ones. The only instance of a Methodist community debating their relationship to the Free State government occurred in Ballineen in West Cork. There, the Methodists held a meeting to decide what they should do. They decided to support the new regime. It may be questioned if they had much alternative, but it has not been unknown in Irish history for entire parishes or congregations, Roman Catholic, Presbyterian, or Methodist, to emigrate to the United States of America. The Ballineen Methodists certainly took the question seriously, and so did their neighbors. When news got about of their positive decision, there was a marked improvement in community relations. A notable case of a Methodist family deciding to remain was that of Arthur Dean Codling, an English Methodist who had been sent to Ireland to work in the Department of Local Government. He and his wife were both from Lancashire. He was given three options. He could go to either Belfast or London, or he could stay where he was. As a Glenstonian liberal, he did not care to work under a unionist administration, and London appealed to neither his wife nor himself. They elected to stay in Dublin. He was transferred to the Department of Finance, where he rose to be one of the two assistant secretaries. Both Kenneth Whitaker and Conor Cruz O'Brien paid high tributes to his influence. A more dramatic experience was that of Jasper Travers Wolfe, a solicitor in Skibbereen. Wolfe became the Crown solicitor for West Cork, and in that capacity had, at various times, to conduct the prosecution of several nationalists. On three occasions, IRA courts sentenced him to death, and for a short period he was obliged to take refuge in England. He returned to resume his career as a solicitor, and with the establishment of the Free State, the post of Crown solicitor was abolished. In 1927, he was elected to Doyle Éireann, the first Methodist to take his seat there. The three men who had presided over the IRA courts, which sentenced him to death, later became his friends. Because of the high rate of emigration, the Methodist population in the Free State, as recorded in the national census, fell from 16,440 in 1911 to 10,663 in 1926. This was a decline of 35.14% and compares with a decline in Church of Ireland numbers of 34.91% and in Presbyterian of 28.71%. From 1926 to 1971, the Methodist emigration rate was close to or above the national average. Between 1971 and 1981, the trend reversed. More Methodists migrated into the Republic than out of it, the percentage being close to the national average. The overall increase in membership was just 2.5%, which came below the immigration percentage. Attitudes and perceptions. Important as numbers are, attitudes and perceptions are of even greater significance. As people see their own situations and feel about their prospects, they take the decision to move or to stay, and so create the sort of statistics we have been examining. Attitudes and perceptions, however, are far more difficult to quantify, and are in many cases not easy to recover after the events. What follows is to some extent a reflection of the writer's observations and conversations over the years, but because recollection can be selective, the circuit ministers throughout the Republic in 1995 were invited to supply information regarding their own areas. World War. It has often been suggested that one of the most significant factors in the decline of Irish Protestant numbers was the death toll of the First World War, when many young men were killed before they were able to marry or establish families. Was this true of Methodists? It is difficult to be certain, as in some areas records have disappeared with the disappearance of local congregations. Some Methodist churches have memorial tablets on their walls recording the names of members who were killed. The absence of such a tablet is not evidence that none were. It has been pointed out that similar tablets in Church of Ireland parish churches have included Methodist names, and in areas where that has happened, or where names were entered on a public monument, the Methodists probably thought no second memorial necessary. Inquiry suggests that there is no consistent pattern throughout the country. It might be suggested that the greatest number of casualties would have been sustained by one or other of the Dublin churches, but this appears not to be so. The memorial porch at Wesley Chapel in Patrick Street, Cork, recorded 24 members killed in the conflict. However, the adult membership there numbered over 450, and the congregation remained vigorous. The little congregation in Bentry, on the other hand, lost only a few of its members, but their loss was so significant as to bring about the closure of their church in a generation. For the marriageable young women of the congregation, any local men were either related to them or Catholic, neither being acceptable. There are instances also remembered of servicemen returning to their native places, failing to settle there, and emigrating in a very short time. The suggestion has been made that the excitement of their experiences or the taste of life elsewhere unsettled them. On the other hand, it is arguable that the basic reasons for their departure lay in the absence of suitable work opportunities at home, or in the political changes in Ireland. In the former case, they would have emigrated, war or no war. The Troubles. From our history, we Irish have inherited two contradictory talents, exaggeration and euphemism. The most applauded skill of the old Senachies was the language with which they embroidered their tales, since when few Irishmen have spoilt a good story by a slavish adherence to fact. On the other hand, when faced with uncomfortable experiences, they downplay the agony. What are now officially called the War of Independence and the Civil War were for many years euphemistically dubbed the Troubles. In an article published in the Bulletin of the Methodist Historical Society of Ireland, Professor David Fitzpatrick has examined the attacks made on Methodist families in West Cork, several of whose members were murdered. It is clear that they suffered not because they were Methodists, but because they were vocal in expressing their loyalty to the British government in Ireland. But the tendency to exaggeration even emerged in the midst of a situation that was bad enough. The story was told of the Reverend Alfred Harbinson, Methodist minister in Dunmanway, whose manse was attacked by the revolutionaries and who was forced to flee with his family in the night and take refuge in the fields. He had letters published in the newspapers denying that there was any truth in the story, and affirming that he had never been molested at any time while going about his pastoral duties. But in spite of this, the story persisted in the region for decades. A story from another part of the country that is not widely known has its roots before 1920. It concerns a small village in the province of Munster. The ground landlords would not allow a Catholic church to be built on their land. The Catholics in the village had therefore to walk more than a mile from the village, a journey that the elderly among them found particularly difficult. At one end of the village was a small shop owned by a Methodist couple. It became known that they owned the freehold of some fields adjoining the shop. The Catholics approached and asked if they would sell them a few acres for a church and a graveyard. They refused. Their Catholic customers, disappointed that they would not help their elderly people, took their business elsewhere. The Protestant population was not large enough to support the shop, and the business collapsed. The premises were bought by another Methodist who took over the shop. The Catholics made an approach to him, and he sold them the acreage they requested. Relations immediately improved, and the business prospered. He had five children, three boys and two girls. However, he made no secret of his loyalty to the British Crown, and in 1920 condemned the revolutionaries. One evening, a group of masked men came to the house and took out the three boys. They did not take them far, and the family heard the three shots. The men sent the boys back into the house, saying, "Tell your father if he doesn't shut up, we will not miss the next time." The shock of the three lads they thought were dead, coming back into the house, unhurt, was nearly as great as the shock of believing them killed. The father was silent on the subject, and the business flourished. It will be noted that in neither episode was the fact that they were Methodists an issue. Why it was not is a point that few people understand. In the 1960s, I, with a number of other young people, visited Leinster House to observe Dáil Éireann in session. As we entered the public gallery, the then Taoiseach, Sean Lemass, was answering a question about the activities of the Jehovah's Witnesses in Ireland. And one of his comments stayed in my memory. He referred to them as distributing literature offensive alike to Catholic, Protestants, Presbyterians, and Methodists. To him, they were apparently mutually exclusive. Through 30 years of ministry in the Republic, while sectarian conflict continued in Northern Ireland, this writer came upon other examples of the same thinking. Many Irish Catholics saw a clear distinction between Protestants and Presbyterians or Methodists. To them, the Protestants were the members of the Church of Ireland whose forebears had demanded the enactment of the penal laws, which disadvantaged Catholics both politically and economically. But to a lesser degree, they also disadvantaged the Presbyterians and the Methodists. So they couldn't be Protestants in the Catholic mind. Employment. Certainly after the initial adjustments of the early 1920s, the single most widely felt cause of immigration was related to employment. In the rural areas, the majority of Irish Methodists have been farmers. Like all their neighbours in recent years, they have experienced the economic pressures that have threatened the viability of small farms, where the family has an acreage capable of providing a good living for one family. That acreage can, of course, be inherited by only one child. The other children must of necessity find other work, which is probably not available close at hand. If the acreage is small, the farmer may only survive with the aid of a supplementary source of income. These factors have affected Methodists no differently from other farmers. Between 1920 and 1960, part of their survival strategy was making themselves as little remarkable as possible. It was called keeping their heads down. Life outside the farm largely centered on the church. After that time, they began to emerge into the community and were to be found not only tilling the land, but also playing a full part in other community activities, IFA, ICA, Mochran Ferma, Credit Union, and so on. In commerce, the situation has been quite mixed. In 1921, a large number of shops and factories throughout the Free State were Methodist-owned. And since that date, other Methodists have opened businesses. Their most favorite trade was drapery, but there were some grocery shops, some hardware shops, timber merchants, and at least one hotel. Some of the enterprises have been highly successful. The outstanding case has been that of the Shaw family. They started with a small shop in Mount Melick, and in two generations have built the business to more than a dozen outlets, justifying their proud slogan of almost nationwide. More have ceased to operate than have survived. In some cases, modern technology made their business obsolete. The White Heather Laundry in Dublin, for instance, ceased to be patronized when the Dublin housewives bought washing machines. In a few cases, there would appear to have been mismanagement or failure to change to modern methods. In most cases, business seems to have been sold or closed because there were no heirs, or the existing heirs were not interested in taking over from the previous generation. That raises questions about motivation. There has always been a strong impulse in Protestant philosophy toward bettering oneself, and Methodists shared in this no less than the other denominations. But was there something in the education of the young Methodists that colored their understanding of betterment in such a way as to encourage their leaving home to seek work in larger towns, cities, or other countries? To this we must return. Of course, not every Methodist owned a farm or a business. The majority were employees. The first generation of Protestant business owners in the Free State took the view, as did other Protestant people, if we don't employ our Protestant young people, who will? Some of them provided hostel accommodation over the shop for their staff. It has to be admitted that not all of them were free of self-interest. There were some who expected those they employed to be grateful for the fact that they had a Protestant employer and to be willing to accept lower wages accordingly. The next generation of employers took a different view. They said, "Our profit comes largely from the support of Catholic customers. We cannot be exclusively Protestant in our workforce." The second view is one with which nobody could quarrel. But one of its consequences was a reduction in the number of positions available for Protestant young people in the provincial towns, and this had an influence on the subsequent pattern of migration. One businessman in the Midlands who adopted this view, when he took over the business from his father, told this writer that when he began to employ Catholics, the rate of pilferage in his shop dropped. The comment left one to wonder, had the Protestant employees been compensating for their lower wage by helping themselves to some of the stock? Methodists have not only sought work in general commerce and industry, some have found work in the semi-state agencies, where a number have risen to positions of major importance. A case in point is George McVitie, who made a distinguished contribution to the work of Ancoras Trochtala, developing many openings in Canada for goods of Irish manufacture. In professional life, Methodists have successfully pursued careers in medicine, architecture, accountancy, and the law. Most Methodists, adopting legal careers, have chosen to be solicitors, but a few have been barristers. At least two Methodists have become judges, which is probably more than denominational numbers would have been thought to warrant. One of them was Judge Brian McCracken of the McCracken Tribunal. Education. In 1921, there were more than a dozen primary schools under Methodist management in the Free State. Today there is one, at Rathgar in Dublin. The others closed at various dates, but always for the same reason. There were too few pupils to justify the continued separate existence of the school. Since the closure of each, the children of Methodist families in those areas have received their primary education in schools managed by the Church of Ireland. The most marked change over the years has been witnessed in the field of secondary education. In the 1920s and 30s, there would have been some Methodist children whose formal education was limited to that which they received at primary school. Of the majority who did receive secondary schooling, most would have gone to Wesley College in Dublin. The choice of this college by so many families was largely a matter of denominational loyalty. In at least one provincial area, an entire carriage was regularly reserved on one of the trains to take the Wesley boarding pupils to and from Dublin at the beginning and end of each term. Some years ago, this pattern began to change, partly for reasons of expense and partly for reasons of accessibility. First, a number of families began to choose the nearest Protestant boarding school. More recently, Methodist children have been sent to local Catholic secondary schools, where nearby Methodist ministers have been invited to attend and give religious instruction to them. The creation of community schools has offered another alternative. If I may divert from the text for a moment, I had to go into Ross Cray to a school there and teach one Methodist girl. And when she went back into class after my teaching, she had to repeat what she had learned from me to the rest of the class. The argument most often used in support of the change to local schools is that in sending children away to boarding school, we separate them from their local community and make it impossible for them to settle back into an environment where they have become strangers. The weakness of this argument is the number who have successfully integrated. Behind the argument may lie a reluctance to admit that in giving our children a higher standard of education than we have received, we may have made them less willing or less able to accept limitations that we have taken for granted. Such inability may have followed wherever that education was acquired. The high rate of immigration and the fear that Protestants might disappear altogether from large parts of rural Ireland led Irish Methodists into their only venture in third level education. In 1947, they established Gertine College in North Tipperary, still the only Protestant college in the country teaching agriculture. Its original policy was to accept only Protestant students, and the members of the Board of Governors were all Methodists. Methodists were always a small minority among the students, the majority belonging to the Church of Ireland. In the 1970s, two changes were made. Catholic students were admitted, and the denominational qualification for governors was removed. More recently, equine courses were added to the curriculum, but the aim of the college is still to enable young people to remain working on the land in Ireland. It is one of the main services which the Methodist Church offers to the Irish community at large. Irish Methodists have entered the teaching profession at all levels. Several are teaching at primary schools. Those who have wished to take up teaching at this level would affirm that they have not been disadvantaged by the reduction in the number of Methodist-managed schools. At secondary level, it was interesting to note that when this report was originally written, in the Protestant secondary schools, three of the principals and two of the vice principals were Methodists, none of them in Wesley College. It is beyond question that the most distinguished Methodist to hold a chair in an Irish university was Ernest Walton of Trinity College, Dublin. He was the country's only Nobel Physics laureate. There have been and are other Methodists lecturing in Trinity and University Colleges in Dublin and University Colleges in Cork, Galway and Maynooth and in other third level colleges. Politics. In the early years of the century, most Irish Methodists were unionists, including those who would have accepted home rule within the United Kingdom. In part, this arose from the frequent protestations of loyalty to the powers that were, which was the main Methodist response to persecution in the 18th and 19th centuries. In part, it arose from the general Protestant teaching against violent revolution. In part, it arose from a sense of solidarity with other Protestants in the community. There were, of course, exceptions to this, the most outstanding being Sean F. Allen, who joined the Irish Republican Brotherhood and became its secretary. The decision of the Ulster Unionists to abandon their southern colleagues and concentrate their efforts on maintaining control of the northeastern counties gave rise to considerable resentment. The sense of having been deserted by their friends was remembered by some of the older Methodists as lately as the 1990s. It may have helped to accelerate the identification of the Methodists with the new Free State, which was nonetheless a long process. It certainly gave them a critical attitude to Ulster Unionism, which is still discernible in succeeding generations. A presence in the national legislature would have been important to members of the Church of Ireland, who, as members of the former established church, were accustomed to such. Methodists were not so accustomed, their presence in Irish politics prior to 1921 having been in local councils rather than in Parliament. While Methodists have found it helpful to know that there was a Protestant in the Oireachtas, they have not often hoped to be there themselves. As we have already noted, the first Methodist to stand for election to Dáil Éireann was Jasper Wolfe of Skibbereen. He succeeded in taking the fifth seat in a five-seat constituency in 1927. 16 years later, there was a second attempt. Niall McCormick of Killala had sat on the Mayo County Council for several years. He was then a member of the Fine Gael party. In the 1940s, the economic hardships of the farming community led to his resignation from Fine Gael, and he stood in the 1940 general election as a farmer's candidate. He was not elected, but the number of votes he secured was not discreditable. A year later, he was one of the founder members of Clann na Talún, but he did not again stand for election. The third Methodist to seek a seat in Dáil was Lionel Booth. He had joined the Fianna Fáil party and stood unsuccessfully in the general election of 1954. He was successful in gaining a seat in the Dunleary and Rathdown constituency in the general election of 1957. Thereafter, he was re-elected in each general election until 1979, when he chose not to stand and retired from politics. He was for some years a member of the council of the Fianna Fáil party. No Methodist has yet stood for election to the Seanad. The only Methodist senator has been Gordon Wilson, who entered the House on the nomination of the Taoiseach, Albert Reynolds. Senator Wilson's daughter, Mary, was one of the victims of the bomb outrage at the Enniskillen War Memorial on Remembrance Sunday, 1987. And his ironical response to the tragedy, broadcast around the world, prevented retaliation by Protestant paramilitaries. His nomination in the Seanad was a recognition of his unique contribution to reconciliation. Social concerns. From their earliest years, Irish Methodists have shown a marked social concern. One of their earliest institutions was a school for boys, which was conducted in the lobby of Whitefriar Street Church in Dublin. Beside this, they built a widow's home, which on a different site continues to provide the needs of elderly women, now both widowed and single. The Strangers' Friends Society, formed about the same time, functioned effectively for nearly two centuries, until it emerged in the 1990s with the Church's Dublin Central Mission. Changing times brought changing needs, and the Church sought to respond to those changes with the same spirit of social responsibility. In doing so, it has enjoyed the cooperation and support of many in the wider community. Some of the ventures have been short-lived for one reason or another. During the years of the Second World War, as supplies became scarce, the Methodist people in Sandymount became aware of the hardship suffered by the poorer residents of Sandymount and Ringsend. They opened a soup kitchen from which meals were distributed. At that time, no financial aid could be expected from government sources, either local or national, for such a voluntary enterprise. But help was given by the Red Cross. The maintenance of the work fell mainly on the Methodist congregation of about 250 people. As conditions in the neighborhood improved and the need reduced, the work was given up. During the same years, Methodists became involved in the various defense agencies, air raid precautions, local defense force, and local security force. Much more recently, an attempt was made in Burr to start a school for children of the traveling people. For this purpose, the Methodist Hall in the town was used. The early demise of this project was due to the difficulties created by migratory habits of the families the school was intended to serve. Of a more permanent nature was the foundation of the Kylemore Clinic in Killiney. The Reverend Dr. Thomas McCracken had taken a great interest in current developments in psychiatry and had gone so far as to qualify himself in psychiatric medicine. He withdrew from circuit ministry, and a group of Methodist business people combined to finance the clinic, in which he practiced until his own health declined with advancing years. The Methodist Widows' Home had been founded in John Wesley's lifetime. In the 1960s, the Dublin Central Mission established some new sheltered housing for the elderly. Called Margaret Home, it caters for both men and women who are housed in flats and chalets with a central administrative and social block. In 1990, it built a second establishment in Glenageary, and within a decade had opened a nursing home and Alzheimer's care center in Sandymount. These inspired provincial Methodists to build similar housing at Embury Close in Adair, County Limerick, and at Ardfallon in Cork City. In other places where other people have taken the initiative, Methodists have been happy to give both practical and financial help to groups seeking to relieve poverty, loneliness, handicap, and other social needs. So far, we've been discussing how Methodists themselves perceive the community. How does the community perceive Methodists? It has been a great advantage of the church that has never been a majority in any European country and has never been an established church as such. Indeed, though a very large church in world times with a community of more than 70 million people, it has been seen in this country as a small minority. The nonconformist conscience, of which English politicians had to take account just over a century ago, and which was largely voiced by Methodists, had no parallel in Ireland. Methodism has therefore been spared the difficulties attendant on much politicization. Only in the 1950s did the conference begin to address Irish government and people on a wide range of public issues. Earlier, its ethical statements were addressed to its own community. The broadening of its intended audience and the understanding that it is only one voice among many has brought the realization that whatever attention it would receive must be earned by the quality of its statements. The quality improved remarkably on the sort of statements put forth in the earlier years of the 20th century. The readiness of the conference to address the powers that be on moral and political issues is one expression of a change in the attitude of the Methodist community. In the three decades after 1920, Protestants in the Free State Stroke era were greatly affected by the idea that they had taken over and were uncertain of having any role in the new regime. As late as 1960s, there were still instances when Protestant families put their farms on the market and an agitation would be made for the division of their land by the Land Commission among the smaller farmers of the area. The future. Is it possible to obtain any indication of the future of Methodism in the Irish Republic? There are those who would be very pessimistic, and in places there are causes for pessimism. In particular, churches are finding difficulty in keeping the young people involved. Two churches in the Dublin area have solved that by arranging a separate weekly service for them. Much of the future depends on the way in which the members of the congregation greet strangers. The churches that grow are those that offer a warm welcome to all who come to their services. The minutes of Conference 1913 reports increases in community of 9 out of the 20 circuits in the Republic. A few years ago, the arrival of some immigrants in Killarney led to the church there, formerly open in the tourist season, being open all the year round. And since then, two other small congregations have started to meet in Kenmare and Mill Street. Not very many years ago, a new all-purpose building was put in place for Methodists in Tulla, and recently on the other side of the city, two small congregations have been meeting. Some years ago, the small Methodist church in Kilkee was fitted with electric light and heating. Heretofore used only in the summer, it can now be used throughout the year. In 1974, there were so few Methodists in Galway that some people thought it ought to be closed. The minister in Clochjordan suggested that it might be kept open for a service once a month. And the arrival of new industry in the city brought new families. There is now a large congregation meeting there each Sunday and making use of the building during the week. The coming of African Methodists into Ireland has revitalized congregations in the center of Dublin and in several provincial towns. These developments are signs of real hope. Thank you.